Hi, I'm Christy Lee, the creator of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents, inquiry reports, and news archives, I carefully unravel and analyze each case, exposing the pitfalls of the criminal justice system that everyone needs to know about. Find Canadian True Crime wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CanadianTrueCrime.ca.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
This season of Island Crime contains material that might be difficult to hear. Sweethearts explores themes of human trafficking, sexually exploited youth, violence, and murder. Please take care while listening. Melissa Nicholson, Sherry Smith, and Kimberly Gallup are ordinary girls. They're teenagers, and they are beloved by their parents, siblings, friends, and family.
I remember Kim as always smiling.
Like, she just was such a lively, kind of happy girl.
And sunny, and she was always so much fun to get together with.
Sherry was just the most adorable child that you could hope for.
Melissa, everything was kind of sparkly. She was just a joy.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart. She fell in love with a boy and she made some mistakes.
And Melissa, she was just a sweet kid trying to survive.
You know, like, she was just a baby. She didn't think what she was doing was gonna end up being the death of her.
Another climb, another fall. Another try, another call. You made your choice to be alone. You had the chance to change it all. Another moon, another sun. You drop your petals one by one. You shut the roses with your gun. You didn't stay, you chose to run. Just sorry, I couldn't make you feel safe. I will give you space, don't you worry. I will learn how to dance in the rain.
Three teens, all last seen in downtown Victoria before they're killed. Kim, Sherry, and Melissa are being sex trafficked on the Victoria Stroll in the period leading up to their murders. I know downtown Victoria today. The inner harbor is at its heart. There are yachts, little passenger ferries, and whale-watching boats. Float planes soar overhead. There's the iconic Empress Hotel and its beautiful manicured lawns. There are statues and fountains at the historic Parliament buildings nearby. There are even horse and carriage rides and street performers, often including a bagpiper. And just north, a straight shot up Government Street, is the area that was once the Victoria Stroll. I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crime Season 6, Sweethearts. This is Episode 4, The Stroll. My research always begins at the center of two circles. The first circle is those closest to the victim. In this case, family and friends of Sherry, Kimberly, and Melissa. I want to understand who these girls are in life. The second circle is those closest to the victims in time and place. I need to walk around their world in the period leading up to their deaths. In this episode, you'll hear from two young women on the street at the time of the murders. Two insiders, both who knew Kimberly Gallup well, one of whom may be an important witness. But first, I'll pull back and take a look at the public view of Victoria Stroll in 1990. Here's what some of those I spoke with had to say about the area back then.
I think Victoria back then was very different from today's Victoria. At that point, there was definitely that sort of British veneer.
Depending on the time of the day or night, there was usually, you know, at least one or two prostitutes. Some of them were working during the day. At night, there could have been, you know, at times there were easily identifiable 10 or 15.
The Stroll at that time, it was downtown in the high tourist area, let's say. It was visible.
The interesting thing was where a lot of the fairly expensive shops were. But as soon as the shops closed, that became the Stroll.
You would see young women in the high heels and the fancier clothes, and it was obvious why they were there.
The prostitutes themselves generally were mainly young female on the down and outs. A lot of them were drug addicted.
The police always control the Stroll. That's really important to know. There isn't like a map and everybody puts it on and the police hand it out. But where the police choose not to enforce is where people go.
A lot of cars coming along, all of them slowing down and studying you, looking at everybody, looking at you up and down.
And the Stroll is where the outdoor sex workers are, right? So obviously the highest risk work environment for a sex worker, because you're going to get into a car, the door is going to close, and you're going to be driven away.
It was quite extraordinary, really. It was such a difference from everything you thought Victoria was like.
I want to speak with anyone who knows that scene, especially those who were close to any one of the girls. I tried to find people who knew each of the girls close to the time they are killed. I want to fill in those details on their stories. I'm most successful when it comes to people who knew Kimberly.
My name is Jessica Bristow, and I knew Kim when I was a teenager in Victoria.
But for Kimberly Gallup's murder, Jessica Bristow could very well have ended up being trafficked as a sex worker as well.
So I was 15 and was sort of hanging out downtown Victoria and getting into a lot of trouble. And during that time, I met a lot of girls that were working on the streets, started babysitting for some of them. It was probably a lot different than how we viewed it at that time. You know, it was probably a lot more dangerous and we were probably at a lot more risk than we thought we were at that time. We felt very much in control of what we were doing, but my friends and I would hitchhike downtown after our parents thought we were in bed, and we'd hang out on the streets and purchase marijuana and hash from people. And then slowly, as the more we hung out down there, the more we started to get to know the girls that were working on the streets.
Jessica is a little younger than Kim. She's just 15. But she is about to take the first step on a dangerous path.
A friend of mine that was living with me at that time, she ended up babysitting for a couple of pimps, and then they ended up turning her out on the street.
Today, Jessica can see clearly what she couldn't see then.
They would pay you ridiculous amounts to babysit, and they would cab you places and give you lots of hash. And so it was sort of like their way of slowly manipulating you. So they sort of would lure people in with babysitting. And I actually used to babysit as well. So it sort of put me on that same path.
Her friend Kim is being sexually exploited. And Jessica now has a deeper understanding of what is going on in her young friend's world.
We obviously all had issues at home. We didn't necessarily come from the most perfect of families. And so sort of trying to find that belonging and feeling like people are protecting you. Kim was really genuine, was really a really good person. And I think that's why we connected so well. Like, she just had a really good heart. She was very thin, probably not much taller, probably about 5'5", 5'6", maybe. She wasn't super tall. She dressed up for work, and when she wasn't working, she was casual.
But Kim isn't getting dressed up for an office job. She's being sexually exploited by traffickers, her young body bought and sold. Kim's parents have described her rebellious, free-spirited attitude. I'm also mindful of the debate around the criminalization of sex work. But this isn't about choice. Kim is too young to consent to working in the sex trade. That's not an opinion, by the way. That's the law.
The first set of pimps were a lot more violent. They didn't give their girls a lot of money. They basically kept all their money and then would buy things for them. Whereas the other pimps were more like you got 50% of your money and they weren't as abusive or as controlling. When she was with the second set of pimps, that was more hotel rooms that they would stay in and just sort of go from hotel room to hotel room.
And Jessica shares a detail I've heard now from three sources close to Kim, although it has never been confirmed by the police or the coroner's office.
I do believe when she passed, she was a couple of months pregnant. She was very much at the time in teenage love, I would say, and he was the father. He wasn't very good to her. Not that they were together, but she was excited. She was very interested in having the father of the baby involved in her life. You know, she was looking for belonging and was looking for people to care for her.
So it would appear Kim, who has just turned 17, is in love, and she is pregnant, just like Sherry Lynn Smith. Jessica remembers well the downtown Victoria where Kim and the other girls were being trafficked. She tells me the girls worked 6 days a week, every night except Sundays.
In Victoria on Government Street, and the girls would stand on the stroll and pick up tricks. That was done in the evening, usually between like the hours of 9 and 3 a.m., I would say. They were out on the stroll there, and the clients would come and pick them up from that area. They often worked in like pairs, you know, like people knew each other and would keep an eye out for each other. I'd often bring her hot chocolate.
When Jessica refers to a trick, that's a term which can be used as a verb to describe selling acts of sex itself, or as a noun, referring to the client. Jessica is rolling her mind back in time, back to the period leading up to Kim's murder. She remembers a party for Kim's birthday on Halloween, just a few weeks before Kim's death. The party is held at a home where Kim has been living for a while. No one could imagine that Kim, just a few weeks later, beginning her 17th year, will be gone. November 21st could have been just another night on the stroll. Kim is working. She's looking for clients. And she's not alone.
She was working in a pair the day that she was murdered. She was working with a girl named Lisa that night. Lisa had seen her get into the car, so she was able to provide a description to the police.
Lisa, the girl who witnesses Kimberly get into the cab. I make a note. She is certainly someone I'll want to speak with. Here's what Jessica recalls the word on the street being the next day. She learns that car Kim got into was a cab, and the place she takes her client is the Colony Motor Inn. Jessica describes the inn as a gong show with a rowdy bar, a place many sex workers take their tricks. Kim is sharing the room with another sex worker that night. That girl needs Kim to move on, so she and her client can make use of the bedroom. But
the other girl that found her tucked into the bed. There was money on the night table, but Kim was dead.
Kim's friends on the street are reeling.
we were all just shocked and devastated. Everybody was. We didn't really know of a lot of murders or anything, but we thought it was a serial killer. It was just the way that it was all laid out did not seem like some random attack, right? For her to be like tucked in with the money on the bedside table and all that kind of stuff seemed very planned and purposeful to us. Like it didn't look like a crime of passion or, you know, like someone just got out of hand. Like it looked very, to us, to our understanding of what the crime scene looked like, it looked very planned. And so we always believed that there was like some kind of patterned killer involved in it. At first they talked about pimps, but we were like, there's no way any of those guys would have like tucked her in and left the money on the bedside table. Like that doesn't even make sense. That's obviously a John and not a pimp. I was around for long after Kim was gone, and there was never any word anywhere on the street that it was any of her pimps.
It's Jessica's perspective that little investigative work is done on the street in the period after Kim's murder.
I didn't talk to a lot of people. I know that they talked with Lisa and probably the girl that had found her. But other than that, I don't think they reached out to a lot of people. I bet they have talked to the pimps, but we didn't feel like there was a big investigation.
Jessica's world changes the night Kim is killed.
It was kind of like it was all fun and games up until that point. The way that it was set up, it was almost tempting. You know, like it looked like fun. You looked like you got lots of clothes and you got to go in a cab everywhere and it looked like lots of fun. But after Kim was killed, it was not fun anymore. That I could see the other side of it. I guess you don't really, as a teenager, see the dark side of things.
Kim's death exposes the ugly truth of the world these young women are entangled in. It's not what Jessica wants for her own life.
She's basically shaped my entire life. Like, I went into psychology. I studied sex work in hopes of being able to prevent other people from going down that path. My own thoughts around sex work have evolved, but what she was involved in wasn't sex work. It was sexual exploitation. So she really had a huge, huge effect on my life.
The idea that Kim's public legacy is that of a teenage hooker, is not how Jessica wants her friend Kim to be remembered.
She was smart. She loved with her whole heart. She was funny and playful and a real joy to be around. She was so much more than, you know, like she was just a baby. She felt love. She felt pain. She didn't think what she was doing was going to end up being the death of her. She was so much more than just someone that worked on the streets.
Hi, I'm Christy Lee, the creator of Canadian True Crime. Join me for an immersive deep dive into some of the most thought-provoking true crime cases in Canada. Using facts curated from court documents, inquiry reports, and news archives, I carefully unravel and analyze each case, exposing the pitfalls of the criminal justice system that everyone needs to know about. Find Canadian True Crime wherever you listen to podcasts or visit CanadianTrueCrime.ca.
I know trying to find someone who was with Kim the night she was killed is my best shot at understanding what happened that night. As you're about to hear, you won't get much closer to the actual scene of the crime than hearing from Kim's friend Lisa. I'm able to track her down, and I begin by asking her to tell me a little bit about herself.
Whenever people ask me that question, I never know what to say. I'm always like, tell me about yourself. I always just say I'm me.
Lisa is 17 when she has her first child. Today, she's mom to 6 children.
I'm a homebody. When I was younger, I was out there. I liked to be in the public. But now I prefer to be at home, doing my thing.
She works split shifts and says her life today is mostly work and then home.
I've tried to move away several times, but the island just calls me right back.
Lisa was born in Kingston, Ontario, but her family moves west in the early 80s. Her sister is a school chum of Kimberly Gallup's.
My sister and Kimmy went to school together. And later on, like, I left home. I ran away from home when I was 14. And later on, I was on the streets pretty much the same occupation as she was. And we ran into each other in Alberta and Edmonton. And we came back here to BC together. And we just, wherever she was, I was. Where I was, she was. We're joined at the hip.
When Lisa is young, she suffers a serious head injury. She tells me this because she wants me to know that it's had an impact on her memory.
Like all of the good times and stuff like that, those are very foggy memories. But the night that we found her, our friend, mutual friend, had found her and came to the coffee shop to get us, like all of that, like that, the night events, it's so clear. I can tell you word for word exactly what happened that night, but everything else is like still kind of, it's like going away. It's foggy. Like, I remember shopping with her and we had the same outfits and stuff like that. But the good times they're foggy, but the night that it all happened, it's still clear as if it just happened.
I want to ask Lisa to tell me more about Kim. But she's anxious to talk about Kim's murder. So that's where we begin.
We shared a hotel room together at the Colony Inn. And Kimmy was kind of going through like a sad... She was dating Isaac, her boyfriend at the time. And they had a fight and I guess were breaking up. And she had just found out that she... was pregnant. So she had found out that she was pregnant with his child and they were breaking up. I'm not sure as to why I didn't push her for information on it. But so for a few days, she was really kind of just withdrawn, kind of sad, moody, kind of. But, you know, I just gave her space. And then leading up to the day, she was actually wanting to leave the streets. I guess with, you know, finding out you're pregnant, that's, you know, she didn't want that lifestyle. So we were in the stairwell and she was crying and she was like, I just want to get out. I want to get out of this. I want to leave. And I said to her, I was like, okay, well, you know, we'll go out tonight and this will be our last night and we'll figure this out. So she dried up her tears and she was kind of starting to feel better because I think she had hope that, okay, you know, I'm going to leave this lifestyle and I got a friend that's going to help me. And so we left. She kind of cheered up a bit.
So many small details of Kim's story are heartbreaking. But this one especially is tough to hear. Kim's in love with a man named Isaac. Isaac is allegedly selling drugs. They both work for the same man, a guy named Dale. The idea that Kim is now pregnant and wanting to escape the world of sexploitation she's become involved in is haunting. I'm not identifying Kimberly's boyfriend or pimp by their last names, as they could not be reached for comment and neither have ever been charged by police in relation to Kimberly Gallup's death. These are allegations only.
And it was kind of like just a really quiet night downtown, as it does usually in the fall time. It gets quiet and, you know, dark and stuff like that. And we were out there and it was just, traffic was slow. There was not much happening. A guy approached her. I was standing kind of further away, so I couldn't hear a conversation. I wasn't close enough to hear any conversation, but a guy had approached her. And they had talked for a little bit, and then they waved down a cab. And as she was getting into it, I was like, oh, you're leaving? And she's like, yeah, I'm leaving now and I'll be going back to the room. And I was like, okay. So everything seemed to be fine. I didn't have any weird feelings, right? So she got in the cab and she left. I continued to stay out. Just there was nothing happening. So a few of my friends came down and then we walked up to the cafe. It's not there anymore.
I can picture the exact part of downtown Victoria Lisa is talking about. I've stood in that same spot recently, and I tried to conjure up an image of Kim, Sherry, and Melissa. There's an old Irish pub on the street I like to go to when I'm in town. They would have stood right across the street. The cafe Lisa is talking about isn't there anymore. But she tells me back then it was the place people hung out in the middle of the night. Lisa doesn't know it, but this will be the last time she will see her friend Kim alive. And it's also possible that she's just witnessed Kim's murderer. Imagine the scene. It's the small hours of the morning. These friends are huddled together at an all-night diner. It's still dark outside. It's November in Victoria, likely cool and wet. Just another night on the stroll. And then...
a mutual friend that we were allowed to go use our room came rushing into the restaurant and was looking kind of really upset. And she's like, she goes, I don't know what's going on. I went to the room and Kimmy is lying in the bed and she's not waking up. And we're like, what? What's wrong? Like, was she sleeping? Because she's a heavy sleeper sometimes. I said, did you shake her? Like, did you try to wake her up? She's like, yeah, I tried waking her up. And I'm like, I go, well, something's not right. She didn't use drugs, so it couldn't have been that. So we paid the bill really quickly, and we all left the restaurant together, and we drove up in Darcy's truck, which was my friend Darcy, Michelle, and Dan. We drove up to the colony, and we parked in the back of it because we always kept the back door ajar so we can come and go without the front desk. We get in there, and it just seemed like it took forever to get up to the floor where our room was. And I was feeling anxious. I was feeling like, what's going on? What's going on? I'm sure everything's fine. She's probably asleep, and our friend couldn't wake her up. And Darcy opened the room door, and I believe he went in first. I went in second, and he, as he went through the door, he kind of just went to the side. He didn't enter into the room, because when he went in, when he opened the door to the room, the bathroom was to the right, and then if you passed the bathroom, the TV desk was on the left, and then the two beds were just, you know, around the corner a bit, side by side. I remember just walking up to the bed, and she was laying there, and she had the blanket was pulled up to her neck area. Like, she was just like laying on her back with her arms down by her side. The blanket was fully covering her up to her neck, and she just looked like she was asleep. So I went up, and on the right side of her was a pillow that had mascara, like makeup stuff on it. And I'm looking at that, I'm looking at her, and it just something that was like, part of me was like, just go touch her, like, you know, go wake her up. But another part of me was like, sorry.
I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, another part of me was just like, no, she's gone. That's, you know, she's not there anymore. So I just kind of, I don't know how long I stood there staring at her. I just couldn't touch her. And then I just, you know, got emotional, and I turned around, I ran and went and locked myself in the bathroom.
Kimberly Gallup, just 17 years old, has been found dead in a bed at the Colony Motor Inn. It's November 21st, 1990. You have to remember, Lisa, is also just a teen. And she's just found her close friend dead.
They were trying to get me out of the bathroom, and I was like, I just can't come out. I can't come out. So I stayed in there, and then I guess the paramedics had arrived because there was a bunch of, like, different voices out in the hallway and just commotion, stuff like that. And they were trying to get me to come out, and I was like, no, I can't because I'm going to see her. Like, I'd already seen her, but my brain was like, I don't want to see her again. Like, I just can't see her like that again. So I just didn't know what to do. I was breaking down. I was freaking out, losing everything, like crying, bawling, scared. So they finally, I don't know how long it took, they got me out of the bathroom. And I went out into the hallway and just collapsed on just further down. And it must have been a long time because I remember seeing them come out with her in the body bag on the stretcher. I remember seeing that and then taking her down the hallway.
The trauma of what she's witnessed shakes young Lisa to her core. She can't recall leaving the hotel, where she goes, or what she does.
I went into some sort of fog. A long time. I just, sometimes I'd be walking and I wouldn't know where I was. My brain just went somewhere else. Like, I was functioning. I was doing things every day, but I have no recall of what I was doing after that night.
One thing that stands out in her memory from this period is being asked to describe the man Kim is last seen with that night.
The police contacted me and the other friend who first found her, and they had us at the police station and asking us to recount, you know, the stories over and over, like how the day went, how the night went, description of the person that we saw her speaking to, the last person we saw her speaking to and getting into the cab with. And we did our best because I didn't really pay attention. I glanced over a few times because they had been standing there talking for a bit, and I just kind of glanced over, you know, like seeing if she's okay. But I didn't really pay attention to the person, just enough that I can give like the color of his clothing, his jacket and stuff like that, and as best I can of a face, because his face was like they were standing sideways to me, so I never really got a direct on profile, like look at his face up close directly. It was always just kind of on the side. So they had us go over to Vancouver, meet with a sketch artist to give our accounts of what this person looked like. And to this day, they've never found this person.
Lisa saw this man more than 30 years ago. Clearly, there is also trauma involved in recalling this individual. But Lisa tries to reach back for any detail that could prove helpful.
He was nervous acting, like, but that in that profession, like, we had a lot of males that acted nervous when they approached us. So that never made me feel any kind of like, what's wrong with this guy? I just know that they talked and it seemed like they were talking for longer than is normal. So that's what made me keep looking over. Nothing really stood out about him that made me look harder at him. He had been around. He had been walking around. And I believe he was kind of just waiting around trying to get her attention. Like, I know he specifically wanted to speak to her. No, but he didn't want to approach any other girls. He just wanted to speak to her. And I think he was waiting for her to kind of break away from the group or get her attention.
Did you have any sense of age?
Oh, he was much older. Oh, yeah. He, like, at the time, Kimmy and I were, I was 15, Kimmy was 16. I would say he would have been in his mid-30s.
Did you have an impression she knew him or no?
No. No, I did not feel that this is somebody that she may have done business with previous. It felt very like he was new to her.
This man is the last person ever to be seen with Kim alive. In the period after Kim's death, police released that sketch. They tried to find him, to speak with him. He is definitely a person of interest. I've posted the sketch on my Island Crime Facebook page. You can check it out there. Kim's murder and the circumstances surrounding it remain vibrant in Lisa's mind. Although less clear, her friend Kim's memory, too, stays with her all these years.
Can I get through this? She was so happy. She was like such a just happy all the time. Like, always smiling, always, like, I call her bouncy. Because that reflected to me, like, what she was always just seemed to be, like, bouncing all the time. Like, happy and bouncy and kind and caring. And she could be quiet. Like, when she didn't know people, she was very quiet around them. But if you knew her, she was always joking. She was always pulling pranks, happy. She would have moments of, you know, sadness because of the lifestyle. It's, you know, nobody's ever happy to be like that. Moments of, like, seriousness. But it was always around getting out of the business one day. But if you were her friend, you felt loved. You know, she would give hot chocolate to a stranger on the street that's homeless on the street. If she had a hot chocolate in her hand, she'd be like, here, you know, let this warm you up. You, like, whenever I was broke, she would, like, buy me food. Because she knew I was low on money, she'd be like, here, you know, let me take you to get you something to eat. Protective of her friends out on the streets. She was very protective.
I ask Lisa to help me understand a question I have about all of these girls. How do they end up being sex trafficked in the first place?
Like, how most of these things happens to girls is they're recruited, but the guys use boyfriend. And I think that these guys, they go around schools, they go around malls, they go into areas where young girls frequent, and they kind of hit on them, you know, like... And the girls being young and they get flattered, they're going to move in on like a dating situation. This is what I have seen a lot in my time when I was out there. That's how the guys procured the girls, was through a boyfriend, girlfriend.
Was that your story as well?
My story was basically I was on the streets for about a year struggling. How I came into it is me and three girls, we were like... smoking weed in a car garage, and we were eating these white powdered donuts, and a car pulled in, really nice looking car, right? And they parked a distance away from us, and then we can hear the car door slam. We're kind of huddled in a group because it was kind of cold, and they approached us. Well, they weren't saying, like, you know, you have to go sell your body for money, but they're saying, like, we can, you know, get you out of this. You can wear nice clothing, could make lots of money and stuff like this. And so two of us out of the group were like, oh, well, we'd like to know more. And I think for me, I can't explain to say for the other girl, but, you know, like, the attractiveness of the guys was what put my defenses down. They were young, they were nice, they were really kind to us, stuff like that, took us out for a meal. But I don't know, it's the lure of the nightlife, all the promises of, you know, you're going to eat out at nice places, you're going to wear nice clothes, you're going to have stay in the best hotels, like all expensive hotels that are in Victoria, we stayed in them. So just as a young girl, I was drawn to that excitement that, wow, this is, you know, I have to do this, but I can put things in the back of my mind and focus on, like, I'm going to make all this money, I'm going to live this life, but I talked myself into it's not that bad. And that's how I was brought into it. I was approached by pimps, and I was basically told that this is what I had to do in order to receive those things that I wanted. And I went for it.
Today, Lisa wants Kim's family to know their daughter was cared for.
I know I wanted to reach out to her family so many times. If you could pass a message on to them, let them know that, you know, I was so very sorry for the loss of their daughter. And that I did my best to keep her safe, you know, keep her happy, and just be a best friend for her.
Jessica, Kimberly's other young friend, also has a message for Kim's parents.
I'd love for her parents to know that, you know, she may not have been in a situation that they wanted her to be in, but that she was very much loved and cared for, and just that she was special and deserves more than just to be forgotten. It still matters because there's parents out there that never found out what happened to their baby. It still matters because of all the people that left her and were left without any answers or anybody to focus their blame and their anger at, because somebody got away with taking one or two precious lives in the same moment and leaving all of us behind to be really affected by that.
This episode was largely about Kim's experience on the street in the days leading up to her death. I've tried to find people who were close to Sherry and Melissa back then to go on the record for this series. In the episode ahead, you'll hear from Melissa's boyfriend.
Of course, being the next boyfriend and stuff, I should be top of the list. You know, I watch enough TV, and the first one you go to is The X, because they kept wanting me to do a polygraph. And I was really nervous because, you know, you can lie on a polygraph and pass, or else you can be nervous on a polygraph and fail. And I was just kind of freaked out about the whole thing. And after a while, and they kind of kept kind of saying that, you know, geez, you know, we could clear you up and stuff like this. And it went on for quite a while. And I said, fine, because I knew I didn't do nothing.
If you knew Kim, Sherry, or Melissa, and you want to talk to me, please get in touch at laura@laurapalmer.ca. Ahead, who killed Melissa, Kimberly, and Sherry? Was it someone they knew? Could the same person be responsible for all three of their deaths? I'm Laura Palmer, and this is Island Crime Season 6, Sweethearts. If you or someone you know may be a human trafficking victim, call the Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-833-900-1010. The hotline is a confidential, multilingual service. It operates 24/7 to connect victims and survivors with social services, law enforcement, and emergency services. It also receives tips from the public.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.